Welcome to episode 38 of Behaviorally Speaking, a podcast featuring board-certified behavior analysts Angela Nelson and Kristen Bondi. On this episode, they are joined with their colleague, Lewis, to talk all things neurodiversity. And now, here are your hosts, Angela Nelson and Kristen Bondi.
Hello and welcome to our 38th episode of Behaviorally Speaking. I'm one of your hosts, Angela Nelson, board-certified behavior analyst and mother of two.
And I'm Kristen Bondi, also a board-certified behavior analyst and mother of three.
Hey, Angie, how's it going? It is going. Today was a crazy summer day with two kids in two different camps at the same time. so I had to enlist my mother-in-law to help. I had a doctor's appointment like 10 minutes after that, so that I'm rushing over there. It's just one of those days, you know, and then rush back here and... It's the juggle of doing work and school stuff and everything all at once. So
yeah.
Rushed
yeah.
Monday.
I know
yeah,
those what about days. You? Yeah. Well, we had vacation last week, so I'm trying to come back to focus because we did all things fun in the sun. So it was just we were outside and in this Florida heat, which is just kind of crazy. We're all a little bit just tired and hot, but I was getting around with a colleague earlier and saying It was at that time it was 3 o'clock and I was like, it's 3 o'clock today, but it feels like it's like 3 days into the week. So it's been that's what it's like coming back from vacation. You gotta get settled.
You gotta and just dig out of all the emails and stuff that are in your mind.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, so we are talking about a really, really important topic today. We have woven this topic into a lot of our podcasts, but today we are going to dive more deeply into neurodiversity and what that means. You know, this is such an important topic. It's near and dear to our heart because we do work with neurodivergent individuals, neurodiverse individuals, what, you know, we'll probably talk about the terminology a little bit too, whatever you choose. And, you know, we know that one in six children is diagnosed with a developmental disability. And oftentimes we pair those, you know, those words together with disability and neurodiversity and so on. We'll kind of break that out a little bit more as well. But naturally, it makes sense to talk about this topic because it does touch so many different lives and so many different families. So it's a really, really important topic that we're going to open up today.
Yeah, I think it's a really good one, and I'm excited to introduce our special guest. Today we have Lewis Chesney here, and he is what we call our resident neurodiversity expert. So we thought, who better to come on and help us unpack this a little bit? So Lewis, do you want to say hi to everyone and just give a quick intro?
Sure. Well, thank you everyone for listening in and hearing about this new topic. It's probably something that most of us are unfamiliar with. And so we hope that, you know, you spend the next hour and you come out feeling enlightened about neurodiversity. Just to get a little bit more into the weeds of what I do. So I've been with this company for about 3 years, and I've been responsible for bringing the concept of neurodiversity into sort of the fabric of the company. And so our culture, the work that we do on a daily basis, and some of the capabilities that we're expanding on. So I feel really excited to have sort of this area in which I'm kind of overseeing at the company.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, so let's actually dive right into it. Lewis, because this is, I mean, it's not brand new, but relatively speaking, it's a newish term. Maybe you can kind of break it down. What is neurodiversity?
Yeah, so neurodiversity is basically, it just acknowledges us and respects us on all the varied ways in which we are. So the way we think, the way we behave, the way we socialize and process information. So it really just considers us in our full humanity, right? We are all across a broad spectrum and nobody is excluded from this. So this includes like individuals with diagnosed who are with conditions like autism, ADHD, and dyslexia. And even those who share similar traits and characteristics, right? So the purpose of looking at neurodiversity in this light is to challenge the traditional medical model of disability. So this is looking at disability through a deficit or impairment lens. And so this medical model, often stigmatizes conditions like autism, ADHD, and dyslexia. So when we see like sort of the mainstream media portrayals, we're predominantly focused on looking at these individuals through a deficit lens, right? And that mm-hmm. can be a little bit more debilitating for them. And then if you have to think about it, like in reality, like we all have our unique strengths and weaknesses, right? And so none of us are average. So if you were look at, let's say, IQ scores alone, they can't just determine an individual's capabilities or potential, right? So we should always focus on like specific talents and strengths. So I may not be strong in vocabulary, but I might be stronger in detecting patterns. And all of these things are areas in which we should honor. Basically, we are all different. And, nobody is more, nobody deserves to be more relevant than anyone else, right? So just think about like, neurodiversity, it's kind of like shifting the focus from the deficits to a strength, right? So when we think about, for the parents of the room, we consider what our children enjoy and what, they excel at. And then, we build the interventions around these areas. But then most importantly, right, and this is where the neurodiversity piece comes in, it's educating those within their environment to impact their success. So educating teachers, educating people in the community about their child, and really just saying, look, you got to recognize my child in their full totality. Don't just see them through their diagnosis. And so neurodiversity really just encourages to appreciate each individual's attributes. That extend beyond their diagnosis. So these are traits and characteristics that can be constant or that can change over time.
I love that. It's really kind of coming from a proactive, positive standpoint where you're really fostering inclusion and kind of breaking down barriers.
Yeah, I was going to add to that. I feel like sometimes parents are quite good at this, right? Like they're able to kind of see through it and say, oh, here's my child is really great in this area, so let's do this or that, right? But some of the struggle, I think, is with those that work with the child, right? So it is about teaching and saying, well, like you said, focusing on inclusion and actually training teachers and staff and even sometimes therapists on that individual. So I think it's so important.
Yeah. And, the holy grail for neurodiversity is really just for every individual to embrace their identities as autistic, ADHD, or dyslexic, and then navigating the world through that lens, right? So that sounds like it contradicts what I was saying before, but really, when we look at somebody who is autistic, who has ADHD, or dyslexic, again, we want to see these individuals in their full humanity. And then just recognize that they have characteristics and traits that are both related and unrelated to their diagnosis. So having this attitude really is vital for, facilitating a growth mindset among not just like the children, the parents, but everybody, the teachers, the community members as well.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that's so great. So let's dive a little bit deeper in. And so we talked about, okay, well, what is neurodiversity? And we are seeing that it's getting a lot more attention over the years, as we said. So can you talk a little bit about how it's getting more attention and maybe in what ways are we seeing that?
Yeah. So we are seeing that the focus is intensified on self-advocacy and self-determination, particularly like when we're looking at our teenagers and young adults when they're ready to transition from the school to adulthood. Mm-hmm. So what this involves is just active involvement from, the child and the teenager, but also, of course, guidance from, the key stakeholders like their parents and their educators and clinicians, to help them to move from the school system to a new system of support. So that's really sort of where we find neurodiversity, where it lies. Within that period of one's life. It's about the self-advocacy and the self-determination. So when we're thinking about a successful transition, you know, we have to think about, you know, the person acknowledging their strengths and their passions. And then the education, you know, when we think about individual education programs in public schools as an example, right? So they are designed to foster self-advocacy and self-determination. And these plans are, you know, tailored to the student's individual needs, you know, trying to get them engaged in the next steps of their lives, things of that sort. And then what are the activities that they can do in school in order to prepare them for, you know, further education and then employment once they get out of school, and then eventually, you know, getting out of their parents' house and living independently. So that's where a lot of the focus is in right now in the schools. But it also needs to go beyond, you know, the IEP. We have to do some culture change. And really, you know, the parents can come in and they could really educate like the students or the parents of the students, the faculty, about, you know, these particular supports. And then just letting them understand, you know what, everybody has different learning needs, right? And everybody can thrive in school and in life with the right conditions. So that's why it's so important for parents to become like really engaged with their child's education to further aid this process. So it's almost like parents, you know, can be neurodiversity advocates for their own kids.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue into the question that we had next for you. So it sounds like, you know, we are starting to see more attention gained, especially in the school system, and parents are diving in. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, some of the ways that parents can support advocacy for their kids.
Sure. So the different tactical things that parents can do is really just work in tandem with teachers, right, to address issues related to homework difficulties, you know, because the parents know their child the best, and teachers, you know, may draw the wrong conclusions about the student if they're not completing their assignments on time, et cetera. So really getting the parents involved and working closely with them, the homework process, and step in, you know, when their child or their teen is struggling. And then really for the parent, this goes back to the self-advocacy piece, is working with the teacher to ensure that the parent is well-equipped to support their child. So, you know, when there is homework to be done, just having clear written instructions and, you know, templates, you know, illustrated expectations provided by the teachers can be really, really useful for the parents, especially, you know, in those situations where their child or teen is struggling. And then parents, right, sort of kind of like it's cyclical. The parents can then, you know, educate the teachers on how to motivate their child, right? So there could be instances where, yes, the child is unmotivated. So what are the particular activities that can be incorporated into the daily school activities? And then most importantly, you know, including coping strategies for stress or like first overwhelming stimuli. So really advocating for, you know, removal of fluorescent lights, allowing the child, you know, time to sit by themselves. You know, all of this advocacy work is really important for the parent. And then it's also important for teachers, you know, to really increase their empathy towards parents. There's so much going on that a parent, you know, may be, you know, lacking confidence in their child's abilities, right? And so they need reassurance from someone else, like a teacher. And then, you know, a parent can also have their own struggles. I mean, what we find a lot is when parents are really uncovering their child's diagnosis, they're also realizing things about themselves, you know, that they had to try to overcome or challenges that are presented to them. So really it's important for teachers to, you know, be accommodating to parents as well. So, you know, when giving parents specific instructions, you know, providing it in written notes, just having, you know, more one-on-one meetings with the parent is really advantageous. Yeah. And just, you know, the more the parents and teachers are working together, the more time they spend together, the more they're able to figure out and navigate through the complexities of transitions. Right. And this could be ultimately at the end of the day could be really enlightening.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking that's one of the number one things I hear from parents all the time is like, how much or how little do I communicate with my child's teacher? So, you know, I feel like that is like one of those big question marks that parents get all the time. So I'm glad you mentioned it. And I think that there, you know, I guess the tricky part is there's not really a right answer, right? Like
right.
Some teachers are overly communicative and others not so much. And same goes for the parents. So, but I like the way that you had said it, like, you know, time that the two or sometimes in multiple teachers, the more time they spend together, the better they're going to collaborate. So yeah, yep. That's a really good call out.
Yep.
Absolutely. I wanted to mention a side note too. One of my kids had a child in their class that was diagnosed with autism. And what I did as a provider, as a professional in this space, I really wanted to advocate for that child and to make sure that all the kids were inclusive and had a good understanding and so on. And so we didn't talk about that child in particular, but I went into the class and I read a book about autism, just in general, right? And, you know, the kids were really insightful and they were really interested in it. And I think, and it was great that the teacher allowed me to go in and read this book. And, you know, again, we didn't identify anything regarding the child, but it was a good way for me as a not only a practitioner, but just as a parent to go in and kind of support that advocacy, support that child and make sure that the kids were really inclusive. And I think it helped the teacher too, to make sure that, you know, she really understood autism and what it is.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if I ever told you this, Angie. So I have a parent that I have spoken with for a while now, and his son actually brought home, essentially, you know, I'm air quoting, a YouTube video and said, "Hey, Dad, I really want you to watch this." And it was a YouTube video about kids with autism, and it was really good. And anyhow, so he had been trying to get the dad to watch it, and the dad just kept kind of putting it off a little bit. And we ended up having one of our consultations, and his dad had told me about it. And he's like, "You know what? I'm going to watch it right now." And he watched it right then because he was putting it off, and he ended up watching it. And the son was like, this is me, Dad. Like, this will help you understand me better. And the dad was like, "Wow, like this, it opened up so many doors for me to understand." And I was just like, that is so cool, because that actually came from the school, right?
Yeah,
the school provided it. And then the son, you know, was advocating for himself. So,
wow,
yeah, awesome. Just a really cool story. Yeah. Okay, so let's keep going. So I know we obviously talked about, you know, ways that how can parents support their kids in the classroom? But
really?
Something that we're missing is, well, how can parents support their child, right? So, you know, obviously supporting through the lens of the classroom, but in general, how can they provide more support to their neurodiverse children?
Right. So, you know, it really starts with just being in tune with your child. And, you know, even if your child, you know, is exhibiting traits or characteristics that may lead to or have led to a diagnosis, you know, you understand that, you know, this is an integral part of your child, right? And just not settling with the fact that this is it, but the fact that this is, right? And so avoiding or, you know, denying, you know, these traits and characteristics, it's not very helpful. Right, because it prevents, you know, parents from fully understanding their child's needs, but it's also important at the same time, you know, for parents to see or strive to see their child as an individual and not merely through the lens of diagnosis. So it's almost a paradox, but really it's about being grounded in reality, but also acknowledging that your child is beyond a label, right? They are, you know, complex, and they have so many different facets about themselves that you wouldn't find in a DSM, right? Description.
Right. And, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? We all fall prey to erroneous perceptions, right? Every one of us, I mean, you know, I was going back to what I was saying before, like there's so much inaccuracy in storylines surrounding conditions like autism.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of like having more and more exposure to these misconceptions that are further, you know, perpetuated by media portrayals, it's really crucial for parents to look, you know, beyond these, you know, misleading narratives and just understand that their child is a unique individual with specific needs, strengths, and passions. And then just, again, you know, going off of that, like having a clear understanding of like what your child is able to do, what they're interested in, you know, can lead to more, you know, successful interventions, right? Interventions that are more appropriate for their child and strategies, just general strategies for navigating through life. So, you know, I know this podcast is about, you know, behavioral health, but, you know, there's also opportunities to be that advocate, that neurodiversity advocate, and identify like potential areas for system change, you know, within the education system. So maybe the child or your child doesn't necessarily have to modify every single piece of behavior unnecessarily, especially if it doesn't hamper their social development or cause harm to themselves or to others. So, you know, an example of this is, you know, the school environment could allow a child to engage in stimming behavior, which for those of you who are unfamiliar, it's just self-stimulatory behavior often seen with individuals with autism to cope with overstimulation in their environment, you know, like fluorescent lighting and a lot. And so, you know, educating the teachers, educating the students, the parents, you know, about these necessary coping mechanisms can really foster a more accepting and inclusive environment for the child.
And one thing that I think is so important there that's kind of standing out to me is accepting, right? When you're when you're comfortable with it as the parent, right? Accepting that this is my child, this is who they are. And I get asked a lot from parents, do I tell my child they have a diagnosis, right? Like that might be one of the bigger, one of the more common questions I get. And that's a hard one to answer too, because, you know, everyone has a different kind of opinion on that. But I feel like it's a really good, the way that you defined it is like, well, we're not really doing them any service here if we don't tell them, right? And I'm sure it's controversial, but yeah, really important.
Yeah, it's great. It's great because even if you tell the child, and you could say, well, this is who you are and embrace it. And even and now you're empowered to tell other people who you are and you know, and what are the common, you know, strengths that a person with this diagnosis might have. And really just giving the child the opportunity to celebrate their identity could be helpful as well. You know, the issue, you know, is going back to the parents, you know, fearing that, you know, because of the misconceptions and the stigma attached to diagnoses, it's like it's going to make it that much harder for their child to really stand out and or fit in, I should say, fit in with the other students. So it's I think once we get to a point where there is less stigma attached to different diagnoses, it'll enable, or I should say empower, anyone who has been diagnosed to come forward and say, this is who I am and this is who I identify as, and I am, you know, a bundle of different traits and characteristics that are, you know, that are either attributed to my diagnosis or not attributed to my diagnosis. They're just a part of who I am.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if parents are comfortable and, you know, accepting their child for who they are, that's going to shine through, and that's going to send a positive message to the child too, which is your diagnosis does not define you. You are
you know, Bob or Susie or Jamal or whoever, you know, whoever you right. are. And this is just one piece of your identity. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like maybe we should do a whole podcast on talking to your child about a diagnosis, you know, that kind of the general recommendation is like when they start asking questions, that might be a sign that they're ready to, you know, discuss it. And we've just seen, you know, this is a very personal choice and personal preference, but, you know, just in the many, many, many parents that we work with, we've just seen a lot of positive things that come with being open and honest and accepting of your child and kind of talking about the diagnosis in a way that's not a secret, essentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so moving on to our next question, let's talk a little bit about inclusivity. So how can parents help their kids be more inclusive? And this is not just parents of children who may identify as neurodiverse, but in general, how can we as adults, as parents, help our kids to be more inclusive people?
Sure. It's about instilling the values of valuing differences within the child. And the way to do that is just simply going to museums, different cultural institutions, making sure that the child is interacting with a variety of different people, you know, looking at their friendship circles and ensuring that, you know, their friends aren't all cut from the same cloth. That's I think where it starts. And then, you know, the other point that parents can make if they ever get objections from their child is like, look, when you're with different people who are different from you, that enriches one's life, right? Because there's a richness of life that's often found in diversity, right? And it makes life more exciting and fulfilling. So really instilling that message in the child at a very young age is so important. And you know, children will often encounter individuals who differ in physical or mental disposition. So instead of advising like the child to like overlook these individuals, like don't look at that person.
Don't stare.
Don't stare. Exactly. You know, you're being rude. It's like parents can use that as an opportunity to teach respect and understanding, right? So they can emphasize, look, everyone is unique. While some differences are more visible than others, no one should feel ashamed of who they are, including you. I think that's the message that should be instilled. And then the other ways in which parents can help their children is really to help them understand that people just strive to align their lives with their values and ambitions. And so there could be, you know, instances where there's just unfairness and there's disadvantage. So in these cases, if somebody is needing help, let's say if it's a peer or a classmate, you know, that needs help with, you know, some sort of art project, offering that help to that other students, if they see that the student is struggling with using scissors and cutting along the lines, like stepping in and saying, do you need help with this? With the anticipation that someone else will be there to help them. So that's the other area that could be really helpful in sort of building that mindset of inclusiveness within the child. And also just getting an understanding of inequities, right? That there are inequities in this world, but then each one of us, you know, has the power to help somebody. And another example could be, you know, helping a blind person cross the street, or you know, opening the door for the elderly. Like things like that can really instill that value of helpfulness, you know, within the child.
It's almost like kind of dispelling the old fashioned, like, don't stare. It's not, you know, like, look the other way, or it's none of your business, but instead kind of lean into it, offer compassion and, you know, acceptance, and yeah, to kind of lean into it. Don't be afraid of something that's different than you, kind of embrace it and, you know, include those individuals and offer help and compassion, you know, when needed.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I was going to add that this one is, I think this is so important because we say this a lot on our podcast, but your kids are always watching. So you can do things, right, to be intentionally more inclusive in various scenarios and really point that out to your kids, you know? So I feel like there's a lot of teaching opportunity within that one.
Yep. And then when those kids grow up, you know, they're going to have that value of diversity and they're going to bring it into their workplace. And so that creates a demand for it. So it kind of builds a stronger incentive to seek diverse candidates. So it doesn't really necessarily have to be a mandate. It's the desire to work people who, you know, come from different perspectives will be already there, right? And it'll come from within. And of course, we all know, you know, the benefits of diverse workforces, you know, reducing groupthink and having broad perspectives and so forth. But unfortunately, you know, we talk the talk, we don't walk the walk. So I think for future generations, I have hope if these values are instilled early on.
Me too. Well, you once again have segued us so nicely into the next question. So we talk a lot about, you know, schools and children and what parents can do. So we wanted to spend a little time, too, talking about the workplace in general. So what's going on right now in terms of neurodiversity in the workplace?
Sure. So we all know, I mean, especially if you're a parent of a teen or young adult who's trying to enter the workplace, that it's that, you know, there's a lot of obstacles in the employment process. So what we've been seeing, you know, over the past five, or I should say maybe close to 10 years, between 5 to 10 years, I should say, a lot of companies have started to move away from, you know, traditional hiring models in favor of more inclusive and alternative approach. And I'll explain.
Sure.
So this is known as like neurodiversity hiring. And so not to kind of belabor what it is, but really it's just, you know, it involves having a dedicated team for recruitment. So having people within the talent acquisition team partnering with community organizations like vocational rehabilitation, national nonprofits with local chapters who are being approached by individuals who are seeking employment and need help. And so approaching these organizations, if companies do so, they'll be able to build out their talent pipeline to include individuals who are neurodiverse. But again, it doesn't stop there because once they get to the interview, there's a lot of issues that can be presented, including, you know, our traditional Q&A type of interviewing process. If a person needs a little bit more processing time before responding to a question, you know, receiving a firestorm of questions in an interview is not going to be helpful. And again, the person might be assessed based on their performance as opposed to, you know, what they could really deliver to the job. And so there's been alternative interview and employment methods. It's just, you know, there's companies that are doing it. You know, whomever is working within HR, you know, this does seem, you know, to place a lot of pressure on companies. And I could tell you that, you know, companies like JP Morgan Chase, DXC Technology, Ernst & Young, SAP, they've implemented these practices and, you know, they've reported positive results, including increased productivity, accuracy, and effectiveness. But for those of you who are a little bit reserved about this, where we are heading moving forward is we're not so much creating these siloed programs. We are focusing right now, and when I say we, I'm talking about employers, on integrating neurodiversity principles in how we conduct business and HR practices. So what we have been really focused on here at Rethink Care is educating people on the benefits of neurodiversity that extend beyond team members who happen to be neurodiverse, right? Looking at it as sort of a halo effect. And I could give you a few examples of these. So we all can benefit from clear communications, you know, less distractions in our environment, because all of these things can benefit our performance, whether we are neurotypical or neurodiverse. And then for managers, like tailoring their styles to suit the individual needs of their direct reports enhances the relationships that they have with their direct reports. But then also it encourages, you know, the embracing of different perspectives. So another important thing to consider is middle management and ensuring that managers are also on board, you know, with neurodiversity, and they're bringing those ideas into their team. And yeah, just we are probably, when we look at the size of the community, it's about 20% of the population. And so realistically, a lot of organizations already have neurodiverse individuals within their workforce. So many organizations could improve their HR practices, you know, to reduce the inefficiencies. And one of those things that they can do, and, you know, this is, you know, this is very related to what we do together, is that one of the things that happens is that employees may not use their voluntary benefits because either they're uncomfortable with disclosing that they have a child with support needs, they have a disability or a specific need. And so this, you know, really leads to missed opportunities for them to get the necessary support. So collectively, what we can do is really challenge this persistent stigma around neurodiversity by first educating ourselves on, you know, looking at different conditions like autism, ADHD, dyslexia through a strength-based lens, you know, looking at the misconceptions that are out there, and then understanding that there is no one way of being autistic. There's no way, one way of having ADHD or being dyslexic. Because if we don't do this, what will happen is we're just going to continue having a workplace where employees aren't getting the managerial support that they need. And this leads to like lower job satisfaction and performance, which impacts the bottom line. You know, there's also risks with non-compliance with the American with Disabilities Act, and that could lead to litigation, and then just lack of awareness of accommodations during the hiring process, right? Which could lead to edging out individuals who are neurodiverse. But most importantly, like if we focus predominantly on the deficits rather than recognizing the strengths of neurodiverse individuals, it could really be a loss for companies, especially now with AI coming on board. You know, we do need individuals in organizations that are really divergent thinkers, you know, that they think outside the box, and they're coming in from a unique perspective and adding value to what's already there.
Yeah, I think you touched on so many important points, and I think you gave a good, almost kind of historical perspective of, you know, we've got some front runner companies that are really starting to change interviewing practices and hiring practices and so on. But it sounds like it's, and you know, the three of us together, plus some of our other wonderful colleagues are in this space right now, working on a lot of things. regarding neurodiversity in the workplace, but moving towards integrating kind of, you know, overall supports and inclusivity across the board, not siloed, but educating people and making sure that managers and HR folks are equipped and knowledgeable about neurodiversity and how do we kind of tweak some things to make everybody successful. So it's kind of, we're kind of transitioning to that. And maybe even we're starting to see more of these practices are being folded into the diversity, equity, and inclusion, the DEI kind of initiatives, which is really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so important to start with neurodiversity. And I'm saying this selfishly because when we think about the principles of neurodiversity and recognizing that we all come from different backgrounds and experiences and perspectives, that's applicable across race, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity. And so building in that acknowledgement and really honoring it and seeing its value can not only help individuals who are, you know, neurodiverse, but individuals that are coming in, you know, from different different sectors of society, you know, who may be going into an environment that, you know, they're surrounded with people who are not like them, you know, who don't look like them, who don't have similar experiences. It would be great, you know, to build out an environment where if people are cut from the same cloth, that's an issue that needs to be addressed. Right. And we're still working on that.
Yeah. Well, that actually takes us to our last question really nicely. What are you encouraged about, Lewis, in the workplace when it comes to neurodiversity? What's looking up for you from your vantage point?
I think it's more and more people are talking about it. I have to say, the friends that I'm close with, you know, who live in, I'm based in Astoria, Queens, so I live within a great community, and I've made a lot of friends here, and they're aware of what we do.
Sure.
And they've come forward and they said, look, you know, I struggle with writing, with you know, it takes a lot of effort for me to write, and I'm not sure why, you know, this is, or I find myself when I'm talking to others that I'm not picking up on specific cues. So people are becoming a little bit more attuned, you know, to certain aspects of themselves that may have presented challenges for them, in particularly, you know, in environments where they're expected to perform, like, you know, the person who doesn't pick up social cues says he has difficulty with dating. And then there was a friend of mine, we were celebrating July 4th together, and our mutual friend had fireworks, and he had stayed behind. He didn't want to be close. He said, I don't like loud popping sounds. And then he started to go into, hey, I might be neurodivergent, and so forth. I said, okay. I think the most important thing is what you're doing right now is that you're advocating for your needs. You're not going out there to make others comfortable just by having your presence. You're staying inside because that's what you need right now, and that's really going to help your well-being ultimately. And so I feel positive that people are not just being in tune to the things that present challenges to them, but also really just advocating for their needs. And a lot of times when someone is asked for accommodations, it really doesn't infringe on the, let's say we're going back into the workplace, it doesn't infringe on the quality of work that they produce. Or it doesn't infringe on the quality of work that other people produce. Or it doesn't really interfere with relationships. If someone doesn't want to go out for drinks after work, then let them stay behind and don't hold it against them. If somebody, you know, doesn't feel comfortable with presenting, that's fine. If they need a script or if they need, you know, something in front of them to guide them, then, you know, let them do it. But have that reassurance that when somebody is asking for a particular accommodation or expressing their needs, that most of the time it's not going to have a negative impact on the work that's going to be produced. Like, that's just, that's something that we need to remember.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's a great way to wrap it up. Yeah, I was just thinking that. Such a good, so many helpful tips in here, and just I have so much great information. So I hope everyone, or all of you, are able to walk away with a little something. Thanks, Lewis, for joining us. We were so happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me. This has been an enriching conversation for me.
Yes.
Thank you for giving me a platform to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining us on our 38th episode of Behaviorally Speaking. On our next episode, we will be discussing keeping kids safe. So until then, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform so you never miss an episode.
You've been listening to Behaviorally Speaking with Angela Nelson and Kristen Bondi, brought to you by Rethink Care. Find out more at rethinkcare.com. You can find past podcast episodes under the Resources tab. We also invite you to subscribe, follow, like, and leave us feedback wherever you listen to podcasts. Your feedback helps us prepare topics and content for future episodes. Until next time, have a great day.